Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 247, and it's proudly brought to you by the ever-growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and interested in supporting the show yourself, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. Hey, Jason, how are we doing? Still out there on the road?
No, I got into my buddy's house last night here in Milwaukee. Drove straight from Venue West, straight from Windup, and just drove about an hour and a half north up to Milwaukee, and I'm spending a couple days here, kind of decompressing a bit from a busy, very social weekend. But man, I'm still glowing from what a great show it was.
Yeah, we had an absolute blast. Your audio sounds a little bit different. We had some technical problems, so we're recording it through Zoom. I think it should be fine. But the show was an absolute blast, just like a very busy 48 hours, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, you drove in, did so with no AC, which I still find terrifying and, I guess, funny in some ways. Pretty much no problems. Like, everything just kind of worked out. We had a really good time. We did office hours on Saturday with Citizen. They were kind enough in helping us both get to the show and also throw a little event that evening at Great Central Brewery. So a huge thank you to Citizen and, of course, to the brewery. We did a really fun recording the next afternoon with Worn and Wound, of which you'll hear half of it in this episode. I'll explain that as we get to it. And yeah, we just saw a bunch of old friends and made a bunch of new friends and saw some great watches. It's hard to beat for 48 hours, right?
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to not only see everybody, but just to, well, for one thing, to reconnect with you. I mean, it had been a year,
so
right?
Long. I think
the last time we met was at Windup 2022. Mm-hmm. And the first day of the show, well, sorry, the first day we were at the show, you know, I got up early and I went and participated in this Windup in a Lake event that was sponsored by Benroos and organized by our chums, Chris Soule, Kyle Snar from Worn and Wound, and another friend, Chris Scott, who's a dive instructor based out of Chicago, and did a dive on Saturday morning. Saturday was a long day for me, but it was just a really fantastic time. Finished off with our that amazing event at Great Central. I mean, I could not believe the turnout for that.
No. We aren't really sure. We didn't count that carefully, but y'all didn't drink all the beer, so we knew we had some leftover beer tickets at the end of the night. So we think probably like 115, maybe 120 people showed up. At that point, because it was so much more than I kind of expected, there were so many people we didn't even get a chance to say hi to.
I know. Really disappointing.
Which is kind of the only thing that I feel a little bit disappointed, because it was great. The pizza was great. The beer was incredible. It's a perfect spot. Next year, I think we take the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we asked them if they wouldn't mind serving the pizza so we could have just walked around.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really nice to see a lot of you. I know a lot of you just said really quickly a hi when we handed out some tickets for the raffle, gave a watch away, gave a hat away, cantonment stuff. It was, I had a great time. Talk about something I'd love to do way more than once a year.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. And we had some folks that flew in, a lot of people that drove from a fairly wide radius.
Yeah.
You know, coming from a number of different states. And yeah, I mean, I'm always struck. I remember kind of this sort of afterglow after last year's Windup, just the, you know, the outpouring of loyalty and friendship and everything from everybody that showed up. And I'm feeling it again. I think it's one of these things that sustains us both and pushes us forward to kind of keep making,
totally,
making the show and you know, hopefully doing more of those live events.
It was a little bit of a case study for us with, like, could we partner with a brand and do something that was really chill?
Yeah.
And thankfully, Citizen, about as chill as they get, we got a chance to play with the watches and chit-chat with Citizen, at the office hours. And then we had this event, and it was perfect. Everybody was happy. Everybody had a good time. I think everybody who wanted a beer got a beer. Everybody who wanted pizza got a pizza. We had glow-in-the-dark logo stickers, which I just love. So look forward to those in a future little, merch drop that we should have planned. But yeah, it was just a fantastic event. And I guess the fun thing is for those of you listening who are in sort of the St. Paul area, there's kind of another little hangout happening, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, hot on the heels of Windup, Blake Bettner from Worn and Wound is passing through the Twin Cities this week for, I guess, a wedding. And he had written me, gosh, way back in, man, it was February, strangely enough. And he said, I'm coming to town. Should we do a bit of a get together? And I said, well, it's the week of Windup. So, you know, I'm not sure double dipping like in the same week is going to be appealing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were a number of people. I mean, we're far enough away that probably a number of people from the Twin Cities couldn't make the trip. And Blake kindly offered to buy, you know, a round of beers for anybody that wants to show up. So I've started, you know, putting the word out on the Slack and, you know, kind of my local network here. And we've got a little turnout already kind of cranked up. And I just thought I'd mention it. I mean, this is, it's tonight. So when this episode goes up on the 20th, you know, make your way, if you can, over to Lake Monster Brewing in St. Paul. That's just off of Creighton Avenue, just north of Interstate 94. It's a great spot. I did my book launch there a couple of years ago, and it's at 6 o'clock. And I, you know, I called the brewery and they're like, yeah, you know, bring folks over. We got plenty of room. And I'm really excited. So it'll be fun. I'm sure some of the same folks that were at Windup. I know Matt Ludvigson's going to be there. He said he would come, but then a number of people that couldn't make it. So yeah, please do come if you can. Very informal. Not, you know, we're not doing big giveaways or, you know, any talks or anything like that. It's just hang out, have a beer, meet Blake. So yeah, please come.
And yeah, if you're listening, you've got today to figure out your plans.
If you're listening in the morning.
If you downloaded it this morning, right. You've got 8 hours.
Yeah, or if it's on your evening commute, just turn the car over, you know, around and head over to Lake
Monster. Yeah, change the GPS.
Yeah, right.
Get over to Lake Monster.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
And that's cool that you get to do that with Blake. Obviously, he's a huge part of what's kind of the main part of today's episode, which was a chat with he and Kat from Worn and Wound. I want to get to that because it's a nice long chat. We get the second half of it to play on the show. They get the first half, so you have to go to their feed, the Worn and Wound podcast feed, for the first half of that chat with the four of us, and we get the second. We did this last year. It was fun to kind of do a feed share, and we're doing it again. But before we dig in a little bit more into that, how about a quick wrist check?
Yeah, we've both got some cool watches from the show on our wrists today. I'm still wearing the Benroos that I took diving on Saturday morning. I had, you know, there was a David Lane Design, our kind of friend in the strap business. He had a booth at Windup, and he had a watchmaker at his booth that was doing free like bracelet adjustments and you know, strap changes and things like that. And so I brought over this Jubilee bracelet that comes on the Benroos. We had worn we all wore NATOs for the diving, so it would fit over our sleeves. And so I had this Jubilee bracelet that fits the watch, and I had him put that on. And yeah, that's how I'm wearing it. I mean, this is a sweet little thing. I talked about it a bit in the...
Yeah, and that's the Ultra Deep, right?
It's the Ultra Deep, yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's the Benroos Ultra Deep. It's a 36.5mm reissue of a watch they made back in the 60s. Twin crown, super compressor style case. You know, I think they just crushed it. It's got this domed acrylic crystal with an internal magnifier over the date.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a great piece. They didn't go heavy-handed on any sort of... Fotina or, you know, tinted loom or anything like that. It's just it's a nice little watch. And when I wear it and take it off and kind of hold it, it feels like a vintage piece. But, you know, I dove with it Saturday. I'm going to take it out again. I'm headed out for a dive tomorrow morning with my buddy Chris here in Milwaukee. And I'm going to try to get it wet again. So, yeah, it's passing the test. And it's just been a fun piece to wear. I think it was kind of a big hit. I think people at the show were pretty jazzed about it.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a shot of it in the photo report, which will run on Hodinkee. It'll come out on Tuesday, so by the time you're listening to this, if you missed it, swing by Hodinkee. We did a little photo report from Windup, just because we saw so many fun watches.
Nice.
And yeah. This, certainly that Ultra Deep was one of them. Really pretty, really nicely sized, like a small watch that kind of wears a little bit bigger or with more presence because of the dial.
Yeah.
And the internal bezel.
Yeah.
Really slick.
Yeah, I think it's a really promising piece that a lot of people are going to love. And then you've got nice. You've got a watch that we both really liked from folks that we really like as well. That it's a very exciting one. Tell us about it.
Yeah, talk about a watch that we like that checks a lot of boxes. And I do know the price, and it does release this week. So I think it's technically like tomorrow if you're listening to this day one, I think. I don't know for certain. You'd have to check their website. But it's the new Laurier Hydra Series 3. I've been waiting to see this and to comment on it until I saw it in person at Windup, and they let me take it home. So I've got it for about a week, and then I'm going to ship it back to them. This is a 41mm steel diver with a Miyota 9075 GMT. That makes it a Flyer GMT, and they're selling it for $600.
Amazing. Just, I mean...
like, really?
Yeah.
That's kind of all you need to know?
Yeah.
I think it's quite handsome. It has a Hezolite crystal and a Hezolite bezel insert, 200 meters of water resistance. Fully steel case, comes with a steel bracelet, which is quite nice. Single-sided screws. I sized it in 10 seconds this morning. It's got a few little points of micro adjust like that you'll need a little tool for. But otherwise, it's this nice felt sort of flat link bracelet. The case is lovely. It's 12.2mm thick. And I think it wears kind of that way. Plus, they say it's another 2.4mm for the dome of the crystal. The crystal adds an incredible amount of personality to the watch. It distorts the dial. It really gives it quite a bit of presence. but it does wear something like 12 and a half ish sort of on the wrist, and then it's only 46 millimeters lug to lug, 20 millimeter lug width, and you have drilled lugs, a protected crown due to kind of the case shape, and then it's just this really pretty dial design that I would say is like in the same sort of headspace, mid-century headspace, as like a Serica.
Oh yeah.
But then it's iterated with a white 24-hour Riut, which is luminous, and then sort of an internal dive-style dial in like a slate sort of flat blue that matches the dive bezel, which is 120-click, really nice. Like as nice as a 120-click bezel needs to be. Just accurate and smooth and light, but super clicky. It's all loomed. The bezel, the hands, the markers, the 24-hour scale, and then you have a red GMT hand or second time zone hand and a date at 6. And then with the 9075, you're doing local jumping with date correction in both directions. And again, it's $600.
Yeah, kind of a dream watch, right? Yeah.
I'm wearing it. I really like it. I'll definitely attempt to buy one, like I assume many of you will.
Yeah.
I think these will be exceedingly hard to get for some time. I don't think you can blame a brand as small as Laurier. They're going to make as many as they can sell, right? But I think they've kind of cracked a pretty wearable, good-looking code at a price point that not many people are touching with the 9075. Vare is pretty close with the G5.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, one thing that I've always been impressed by with Laurier was I was chatting with them at the booth yesterday, and Lorenzo, it's a husband and wife team, and Lorenzo does most of the watch design. And I mean, he hits the mark every time. The watches are just beautifully styled. And then they do this kind of clever mid-century looking advertising, you know, these kind of faux magazine ads that they had on the table. I mean, everything just feels really sort of cohesive in terms of the whole brand. And, you know, that's a hard target to hit when you're, you know, a really small company with, you know, presuming a limited time and budget and that sort of thing. But they nailed it. And you could tell by the presence at their table. It was a hard time to even, you know, get FaceTime with them because it was always like 3 or 4 people deep every time I walked over there.
Totally. Yeah. If you like the idea of getting into a micro brand, maybe you haven't been down the road with a Halios or an Astor and Banks or even like an Oak and Oscar, like some of the higher end stuff before, I think this is a great entry point. And it's a watch I'm going to be talking about for a long time because of the price point being at $600. Yes, again, I'll say it again because it'll be a major part of the commentary around this watch for the next while. Yeah, it's going to be hard to get.
Yeah.
They'll figure out a way to take your name, take your number, buy it, sell it, however it works. And they'll be popular on the secondary market. But with a little tiny brand, I can't really blame their production on them. There's like market factors beyond that.
Yeah.
It all feels really nice. It's not a watch that I picked up and kind of believed was going to be $600.
Yeah.
I think even in the recording, I'm not sure which half it ended up on, but in the recording, I was talking about GMTs and I brought this watch up as a watch I enjoyed seeing. And I couldn't, when I asked for a price check, somebody, I think Chris in the front row said $600. I was like, really? All right. Well, let's give him the benefit of a doubt if it's a little bit more. it's a nice thing. I'm pretty impressed by it. I think it's you're kind of getting a lot of what people like. I think it's a watch that will really suit a lot of our audience.
Yeah.
I'll have a lot more on this. We'll do a hands-on for Hodinkee with photos and the rest of it. It might actually even come out roughly around the same time as this podcast. We're still working on that element, but kudos to Laurier. Always nice to see both of them at the show. One of my favorite brands to kind of check out, especially when they hit something that kind of works, just like the new Hydra Series 3. So I'll have that in the show notes if you haven't seen it. And otherwise, if you have and you just want more, stay tuned for a story pretty soon.
Yeah, two appropriate watches and watches that were really exciting to see just a couple days ago. So
yeah, just the sort of stuff you want from Windup.
Right. All right, we should probably jump into our main topic. There's a lot to cover. It's going to be a long one. So, and it was a good one.
Yeah, it is going to be a long episode. We recorded for, I want to say, the better part of an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So just like we did with episode 201 last year, Worn and Wound gets the first half of the episode because their podcast comes out a day before ours. It comes out on Wednesday. So I will link that in the show notes. If you don't already follow them, you should. You should have them in your feed. But in the event that you don't, you'll be able to click in the show notes and jump to that episode. We would definitely recommend you listen to that episode first. it was a pretty flowing conversation. Like you'd still have a good time, but it's going to make way more sense if you start at the start and then come back to our half of the episode.
Yeah.
Our half, you know, we had a really nice time with Kat and Blake and we chatted a bunch and then had a ton of time for audience Q&A. And then we wrapped up the show and I jumped in a car to get to the airport pretty shortly after that.
Yeah.
pretty straightforward format. If you have any feedback, obviously let us know in the comments. Hit us up on the Slack. The rest of it, I'd love to be able to do more episodes with the folks from Warner Wild. It's just so easy. And Blake and Kat, a huge thank you, not only for kind of having us at the show, but also for making us part of the podcast plan. So a huge thank you to everybody who came and watched the recording live and asked questions. And for the rest of you, maybe we'll see you next year or at a future event. Let's get to the tape.
And maybe this is a good opportunity to kind of get a gauge on like the sentiment around like just kind of, so like the watch you're wearing recreates an old watch almost to a T. Of course, this has been a trend, I should say, since, you know, the Black Bay kind of kicked it off.
Maybe even the Longines Skin Diver.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But now it's kind of like one of those things where you know, brands, is there an expectation on brands to kind of bring back old designs? And
I
like,
so.
Is that kind of like run its course a little bit? Do we want to see the micro girders pushing things? Like, do we want to see brands like, okay, well, we know you've done great things in the past, but when I look back in 30 years at this era, what will it be defined by? Will it be defined by watches that look like watches from another era? Or should we have an expectation of brands that they're kind of pushing ahead at the same time?
I think it depends on the brand. We now have a bunch that are literally just vintage reissue brands. Aquastar, I don't actually know how to pronounce this. So Nivada Gretchen. I've heard it two different ways. Like, I mean, I think there's a lot of brands that like that's going to, Volcane is back with like all throwback pieces, right?
And there's some great ones, to be honest.
There's nothing wrong with the watches. It's just a philosophy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it is the philosophy that'll mark the next decade. It definitely has marked the last one.
I think there's going to be always an audience for both, right? And I think there's a lot of brands here that are leaning towards the vintage. And there's a lot of brands like, you know, Christopher Ward is one of them that I think are kind of a mix. You know, I've seen them sort of lean towards the more homage-y territory, but then they're also pushing the boundaries with things like the Belcanto. And I like to see both. And if it's done right, then, you know, it's done right. So,
absolutely.
I'm a sucker for vintage design. And I think, I don't mind at all that there are brands that solely focus on that. I was just at the Ben Roos booth talking to the guys there and was like, where do you go from here? You know, you have a kind of a small collection right now of watches that are clearly inspired by and basically reissues of old watches. And I'm like, do you do a different material? Do you do different dial colors? Do you do what? And they're like, we're kind of weighing those options as well. But I think, you know, you can have brands that do focus on that because that was their core. And then you can have a brand like IWC that can kind of look back at their past and kind of call to mind a certain watch that they used to make, but then they can do something with an interesting ceramic case or, you know, make an aqua timer that's a perpetual calendar or something like that that looks nothing like an old aqua timer. And I think it's a nice blend, but my personal taste runs towards kind of the reissue style, if not full reissue, but sort of the vintage style, because I think that was the golden era of watches, kind of 50s, 60s, 70s that kind of inspire me the most.
Omega does a good job as well of doing the modern and the considered and then the stuff that's like almost like one-to-one, like a mirror.
Yeah, and you look at like the Seamaster collection, which I keep looking at your blow prof, sorry.
Same.
And you know, they just came out with their 75th anniversary collection of Seamasters, and I'd love to get all your takes on kind of what you think of those, specifically the blow prof, which is my favorite of the bunch. But you know, you talk about vintage design or throwback design. What they've done with the Seamaster Diver 300 is, I mean, that is a design that came out of the 90s. That was a very original design out of the 90s that now has become, I don't know if you'd even call it a modern classic anymore, but, you know, they in my mind, I've always wished they would kind of reissue or bring back the 165.024, you know, Seamaster 300 from the mid-60s. In my opinion, possibly the most beautiful dive watch ever made. You know, but hats off to them for not, you know, I mean, they're just going to kind of stay the course and do their thing.
Yeah. I think certain brands kind of walk a line doing this. Zenith is another one that comes to mind that kind of has a whole collection of kind of heritage watches. And then also another side of the collection that's just kind of like pushing ahead with crazy, you know, type of stuff. Yeah. It's interesting to hear your take on it. And it's almost kind of like a preservation of these designs that deserve to be preserved, which is fair, you know,
yeah.
And there's a lot of beautiful designs. So. Personally, I like the new Blow Prof as well. I like the kind of throwback-ish shape that the case has gone back to. I just wish it was titanium.
Yeah, right. It's a chunk. Yeah. And it's only in blue now, right? So, I mean,
surely others are coming.
Surely, right?
Right. We have to say
it's Omega.
It's Omega. Yeah.
And can I just, my one pet peeve about that watch is that, you know, when it was originally developed back in the late 60s, early 70s, it was designed to be a helium tight watch that did not need a helium release valve because helium could not penetrate the watch in a saturated environment. And all the modern ones have a helium release valve on them. I mean, it's
exactly.
I just wish they would delete that. It was their calling card, you know?
Yeah, and it's, if you hear it, it's like kind of tucked in
unobtrusively. Yeah, it's definitely unobtrusive, but I just feel like they could have made that part of the story.
Yeah, and it's still plenty capable from my perspective as a person who swims on closer to the surface. This is a 1,200 meter, 4,000 feet. Is this like, you know, I'm assuming the wreck wasn't anywhere near
that close.
Depth.
It was
yesterday.
Yeah, about half. It was about half. Yeah, right. The margin of error. Yeah.
Okay.
The when you get a watch with a big water resistance number like 1,200 meters, it always makes me think of the first time I went to Concorso d'Eleganza in Italy. It's in Lake Como. It's crazy fancy, and you're staying at this hotel that like inspired Grand Budapest Hotel, the Tremezzo, and I grew up Canadian. Like if I see a lake, I want to jump in it. Right, like that's all.
Tell me you did this.
That's all I want to do. They have two pools, like one that's in the lake. What is that? And then one that's in the backyard, which is really nice. And
where else are you gonna put your pool? Where else are you gonna put your pool?
Yeah, I don't know. So and they're like, you know, there's, you know, $500,000 Rivas, like dropping fancy people off in black tie, and I go out there like in a pair of Patagonia shorties and a towel that I took from my room. Right. And I walk out to the end of the dock and this guy comes out of nowhere and he goes, sir, what do you need a towel for the pool? I'm like, no, I'm going to go for a swim in the lake. And he's like, nobody swims in the lake. And I go, is it cold? He goes, yes. And I go, that's probably all right. And he's it's very deep, though. I go like, yeah, I only need the top like 6 feet. We're all right.
That's hilarious. I love thinking of it.
Yeah, they were very astonished. But I
thought you were just going to drop like a stone to the bottom.
I guess. I don't know. It's just like why wouldn't you use the pool? It's beautiful. I'm like, your pool's great. This is a lake.
We're never going to see you again.
This is God's pool.
Please leave your Langa on the dock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I left my, what did I have? I had a Datagraph Perpetual. That definitely I left in the room.
That must have been his concern.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, Jason's gone running in a Datagraph.
I did, before. Yeah. Yeah, and Langa never lent me a watch after that.
They never lent him a watch. But
I visited Glashütte years ago, and I was staying in a hotel in Dresden, and I had a Datagraph and that they loaned me for the trip. And I remember I had jet lag, and I got up at like 4 in the morning, and it was dark and kind of icy and cold outside, and I thought, I'm going to go for a run. And I wore my Datagraph, you know, for a run. I thought, it's a chronograph, you know? What else are you going to time with it?
I'm a firm believer that watches are what you make of them.
Absolutely.
So in that moment, the Datagraph was a tool watch.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I think they would have been upset if I got it wet. I think so.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Granted, I sweat right through that watch in the sun at Concorso.
When you showed up, they weren't like, wait, you don't know this Jason Heaton guy, do you? You're not going to go.
These Granado guys watch.
Never heard of him.
Yeah.
It just dawned on me, though, having a serious depth rating like this. Well, I think we have a gentleman in the audience who lost a watch at the bottom of the sea, so it would survive. So if you dropped it, the watch, in whatever fancy lake you were at,
Como,
you know, then it can at least survive at the bottom of it.
It'd be fine.
You know, so.
I actually don't know how deep Como is, but it is very deep.
It's very deep.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then you would be out diving it every weekend looking.
The next wind up in the lake will be at Lake Como.
Yeah. All right. Sounds. Blake, take note.
Approved? Fantastic. Fantastic.
Up,
we'll rent the spot where Bond did his convalescence. Yeah. After the scene with the whip.
The budget is just quadrupled here.
Yes. Wow.
It's in Lear. It's okay.
I like the direction that this is just... This is just gone. Do you care about depth rating on your watches, Kat?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Smart.
And quickly, I just circling back, of course, because we have to. We can close out on a watch that we love. That I think both of us added to our collections this year, the Pelagos 39.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I think, within a year release.
Yeah.
This was a watch that I think we've all seen this watch here when it first came out. and this is kind of like the recent releases from them. It's kind of that's nice. There wasn't anything really all that kind of weird or anything that stood out to me as like having a particularly great character. And then, you know, I spent a few weeks with it in reviewing it. And it was one of those watches that kind of, it's like the opposite of this. It's like a watch that I want to wear every day.
Yep.
And then like I sent it back and like weeks later it was still in the back of my head where I had to pick one up. This is still a watch that I wear quite often. I had it on the dive and I went swimming with it. No big deal. It survived. I don't know what it is about this watch that has just kind of like gotten under my skin a little bit, but I absolutely adore wearing it. I don't know if you guys have any feelings on the Pelagos 39.
I should probably reserve my comments. I'm probably in a minority. I wasn't a fan. I really always loved the original Pelagos, and I felt like this one just felt watered down. Pardon the pun. It felt like the Pelagos was this very technical. It was kind of Tudor's tour de force technical watch, and the Black Bay was kind of the civilian version, if you want to say that. And then the FXD has a very technical feel to it too. So the 39 felt a bit. It feels a bit like it's a nice watch. I'm certainly it's well made, and for people that are size conscious, I think it's it makes sense. But for me personally, and watches are mostly about personal taste, I'll stick with the original.
People that are size conscious, I like that. So Jason, the whole like first half of my review is like that is me saying, you know, oh, this is like the Tudor losing the plot with the Pelagos because it's very clearly this thing. And then I come around like, oh, you know, it's got these positives. And then I sent it back. And then it was like weeks later that I was like, it was still on my mind.
I mean, 39 is an ideal size for a watch, but I still feel like if they wanted to make a smaller version, they could have kept a lot of the same specs that were with the original. But
fair enough. Kat, what about you? What did you think of this watch when you first saw it?
I have a love-hate relationship with that watch. You know, like you, Jason, I thought that it was sort of watered down and it lost some of the specialness of the watch. I really like the OG a lot. But when I was in the office and I tried yours on, it kind of won me over. So it's a watch I'm back and forth on. Okay. Yeah.
Jason, you just need to spend more time with it and then it'll kind of find
out. Okay, sure. Yeah, yeah. Why don't you lend me yours or James can? I mean, guys were bookended by guys that have them, so.
Well, I'm also a proponent of the original. We're gesturing over here because the gentleman has a beautiful
LHD. That's the way to go. I love that one.
Which is very cool. Yeah. With a beautifully discreet helium release along the 3 o'clock side of the... James, what was your experience with this watch?
Yeah, I mean, I saw it the day it came out. Rolex in Canada offered a photo shoot, that sort of thing. And so went and checked it out. And like, I kind of knew then that I was in a bit of trouble.
Right off the bat.
Yeah, from the photos. I wanted to make sure that the bezel wasn't like shiny. It's bright. It's kind of iridescent, but I wouldn't call it shiny. And the truth is like it's absolutely everything that you guys said that it is, which makes it the exact watch I wanted. It is an ergonomic champion.
Yeah.
It disappears on your wrist. The bracelet's great. I love the T-fit. But yeah, I mean, I think at this point I've written way too many stories about it. So to summarize, like it's essentially a perfect modern dive watch. Except that the loom on the hands isn't good enough.
Yeah, it's a little bit weaker in comparison to the hour markers for sure. I found that the bezel in a lot of lights outdoors looks like gray. Looks like light gray. So it kind of like looks like a ghost bezel.
Watch. Yeah, and the action's perfect. The loom's great. It's a fully graduated bezel. They're like all stuff I'm a sucker for.
Yeah.
I didn't like the rubber when I reviewed it originally. And now I've worn it on the rubber for like 2 months.
Oh, really?
Okay. I love it. It's great. I just had to back it off one. So it's a little on the loose side. From where I would normally wear it. And then I keep going another $200-$300 into straps for 21 mil.
Because it's the 21 millimeter lug span obviously throws a little bit of a wrench into like your collection of NATOs in your drawer, right? I've got mine squeezed into a 22 millimeter gray NATO. And it works. Works wonderfully. Yeah.
Yeah. I did an Erica's in 21, which I like a lot, a flat gray Erica's. That's sweatpants for a watch. It's just so comfortable. And then I ordered up a canvas, a green canvas from a guy on Instagram, his Postal watch straps. And they're like handmade and he tapered it. It's like crazy good. Nice. I don't want to destroy it by sweating in it all summer, but like it's one of those things where like you look down the road and you're like, oh, fall's coming. I'll have little fireplaces and I'll wear my canvas. And
Naturally, be one of those guys.
Yeah. We're all like this.
Yeah. Kat, did you see any watches this year that you were kind of like, that's okay. But then later you're like, I'm going to need that.
Yeah. The Engineer, the IWC Engineer. That one, it was a slow burn for me.
Not good in press photos. Price feels like too much. And then you have it in your face and it's good.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Which one do you like?
I like the titanium.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. Yeah. These guys have won me over with titanium lately. And that's the one for me. Yeah.
What did you guys think? Jason, what was your reaction to the Engineer?
Loved it. Yeah. I think price-wise, probably a little high. But, you know, price is set by these companies and they feel like they know what can sell. And if it does, then the price is right. So it's not my thing, but it's out of my range as a watch that I would consider for what it is. And in the end, I've mentioned this several times. I'm someone that needs a bit of a widget. I need a bezel or a chronograph or something. So that watch might not last with me, but aesthetically, I think it's a lovely piece. Yeah.
There's not even a button on the side of it. James, what about you?
Oh yeah. No, I like it a lot. The titanium's beautiful. Like really, really nice in person. Kind of reminded me of and it's not the same level of finishing because it's a little bit more industrial. It's a little more machined. But when I went from the steel to the titanium, it reminded me of the Odysseus, where I was just like, you're like, oh, this is luxury titanium. You know, I've got a Pelagos on my wrist or I've got a Scirfa that I adore that's, you know, an amazing dive watch for, you know, not a ton of money. And then certain brands can hit titanium really hard. Debatoon, Lange, you know, I think IWC is doing a really nice job with that. And the tropical light colored dial was really fun as well. I could see that being popular.
Yeah, the Aqua. That's the only one that has a polished center link. And I'm not really generally a PCL guy, but I like the Aqua a lot.
PCL.
Yeah, but...
brand new for me. Yeah, I love it. I'm using that.
But the titanium has a polish chamfer. That's why it reminds you of the Odysseus, like every corner of every link has like an interesting facet along it that is polished.
You know, I've never seen a titanium watch like the Odysseus.
It's stunning.
It's five next levels.
Yeah. But. And a nice side effect makes the Engineer seem quite reasonably priced.
Right. There you go. Watch pricing's wild right now. It's like, it's so hard to tell somebody like, if you love it and you can afford it, then it's the right price. Yeah. Otherwise find something else. Cause the options are amazing right now, but it is really hard to say like, is a new white gold Daytona worth $52,700? I mean, almost certainly to the people who can buy it, it is.
I know.
And it's kind of the same
with that's a slippery Odysseus. Slope to start going down, James.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we all end up with Casio F91s.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing wrong with that.
We're $12 in. Let's go get ourselves a cold beer.
It's reasonable. So I think we are about at the stage where we can start opening it up to some audience questions. If you guys have anything that you want to say to us or ask us.
So we've talked a lot today about watch sizing and ergonomics by the numbers. And I think that's something that we as enthusiasts and journalists are definitely keyed into, perhaps to a fault. You mentioned, I think justifiably so, watch brands sort of bristling at focusing on especially just case diameter. But I have a theory that watch designers are one step ahead of everyone else in that they probably have a way to very specifically quantify how a watch wears, like a mathematical formula for what a watch is like on a wrist. And I have long thought that the first like journalistic outlet that sort of cracks that code and comes up with their own watch size factor is really going to be ahead of the game.
Okay. Can I explain something that, thank you, by the way, Chris. So I'll tell you the moment that I realized maybe we take these numbers too seriously. As I was reviewing the 124270, this is the new 36 millimeter Explorer from, I don't know, three years ago, I think. So this was the Explorer returning to its 36 millimeter roots. And of course, the Explorer was, for its entire life, a 36 millimeter watch until the 39 millimeter, I guess, short jaunt that it had. But the 36 millimeter, the new one, shifted the lug size down to 19, the lug span, I should say, down to 19 millimeters. And there's always something about early Explorers that like didn't quite jive with me from a proportional perspective. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. So when I was reviewing the new Explorer one, So I looked up the golden ratio, and then I averaged the diameter to the lug span to the taper of the bracelet. And that ratio came out very close to the mass ratio. And the original one, the same ratio, was like much further off. So in your thought of like, you know, maybe the designers know something that we're, or they're thinking about this on a level that like, that's the kind of thing that I can picture them. Okay, how do we tighten up this watch as a whole on the wrist where the proportionality of everything kind of sings better together that probably nobody would do except they were, unless they were like reviewing a watch to do something like ridiculous like that. But that's when I also, as soon as I finished like calculating that, I was like, should I put this in here? Is this too much? Are we too far gone?
So,
and that was my other thought. Should we start doing this to every watch and then we can get that golden ratio?
Yes, yes.
How about your Ploprof? Have you calculated that?
That's why I was like, I got to walk. This is too dangerous. It's too dangerous.
So I've got a spreadsheet I can share with you because I've been working on the idea of there being a like standardized relationship between lug case width, thickness, lug to lug, dial size to case size ratio. And so, like, I go with watches that I like for me are perfect on my own wrist. So I would start with like the Explorer 2, the 16570. And that one comes out like it's like a 0.84 on the math. I would love it if you could put a number, some sort of a number, and somebody could go like, oh, my wrist doesn't suit a 0.84. Right. And then if it was like a 0.84H, it's heavy. 0.84L, it's light. Like, it just make it a little bit easier for you to have some confidence when you buy something on the web, on a website, right? But I'll share that in the Slack, this the quote unquote, yeah, golden ratio or whatever sort of spreadsheet I've been working on. I put some time into it about a couple years ago.
You could dial it into your own ratio. So it's like the James Stacey wearability index.
I think wearability ideally index. You would know like the size of your wrist and also like the shape of your wrist.
Yeah.
And then it would give you a range that would work theoretically. And then there'd be watches like the Ploprof, the Aqualyn, that would just like, numbers make no sense.
Outliers.
Complete outliers, yeah.
Jason's about to walk out of this room right now.
I don't think I ever shared that spreadsheet with you.
This is disturbing. I think the trouble with this is the wearability is entirely, I mean, it's so individual. Like every single person in this room, I look out here, I see so many wrist shapes and sizes. You know, I have watches that, you know, occasionally I lend a watch to my dad or something. And he's a big guy. And like, he'll put it on. It's just, it doesn't work. And it's like, you know, Kat's wrist is different. James's wrist is different. Yeah. And some people have flat wrists. I have a pretty flat, bony wrist. Some people have very round wrists. And so it even comes down to the strap that's on the watch.
The strap makes a huge difference.
It's such an intangible, it's so difficult to determine that. I think there must be another column to your spreadsheet that relates to...
I can add you as a collaborator.
Oh, yes, this has to happen.
I need more data. But I think the strap is the other... That's like a really good point. Like, you can change a watch with a strap. There's watches I adore on one mount and don't like on another, like wouldn't wear.
That's why I included the taper of the bracelet in my measurement, because to me, that's all a part of...
But you think the taper changes the way it wears or the way it looks?
Both. Visually, on that watch, it did. It was both for me because that was the thing that I couldn't quite put my finger on with the originals. So
cool. Work in progress.
Yeah. Thank you for your question.
I'm seeking educational grants.
If you open that up to the public for everybody to contribute to,
just start filling stuff in.
Crowdsourcing.
I should just make a little tool where you just, when a new watch comes out, you enter in the three values and it populates it onto the spreadsheet.
Yeah. Is there any other questions? Anybody have any?
All right, so you guys talked a little bit about watch materials, titanium on the new Pelagos, and some other things like that. One that I'm always curious about is I love the idea of a ceramic watch. I think they're super cool. And getting to see a few here and the new ones from Zodiac, every time I actually get to hold one, I don't like it. I don't know why. I'll go home, look at it online, and love it again.
Really?
But ceramic is just not a material that's jive with me in the metal, or I guess not in the metal, but you know, in person. I just want to know what your guys' thought on ceramic and other materials like forged carbon were.
Yeah, that's a material that I go back and forth on too. It's a tactile thing that you feel when you pick up the watch. And for a long time, I was that way with titanium. I did not like titanium. I hated it. And it's just one of those materials that's grown over time. There's been watches that I've just loved and ended up buying. And over time get used to. I don't have a ceramic watch. I don't know that I'll ever pick one up again because I have this great fear that I'm just going to bang it up against a wall or a brick or something and bust the watch. But that's just because I'm clumsy. It's a material that I like the look of though too when I see it. And then again, it's just that it's the weight of it. It's feel. Yeah, it's there's something there that's off putting to me a little bit.
When it comes to materials, I mean, I think ceramic has never quite gelled with me. I love titanium. I think it's such a great material. The way it feels on the wrist, the lightness, you know, corrosion resistance, etc. I like the look of carbon fiber. I'm not carbon fiber, but you know, forged carbon. I think like the carbon doxes are really cool. Some of the APs that they've done. What is the new? The Tissot Citadel?
The Citadel.
What is that made? That's
composite as well.
Like cool watch. Like I think they're light and they're kind of interesting to feel. Like they don't feel like anything else.
Also has a sailboat timing mechanism on it.
There you go. Yeah, we're
racing.
Back on that.
Cool racing.
Full circle.
Cool watch for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't so much have the fears of breaking a ceramic watch, but I haven't warmed up to the look of them yet on any specific one. But I think carbon's cool, and I love titanium. But most of the stuff I have is steel. You know,
I think for me the reason ceramic doesn't work is I don't like how perfect it is aesthetically. I like that steel can have multiple finishes. I like the way that it moves in, like brushed steel in sunlight is awesome. Titanium that's well finished in sunlight, however the watch looks on your wrist and you're walking down the street when you check the time and don't even remember what time it is because you're just looking at the watch. And the ceramic has never done that for me. There's exceptions. There are brands that are brushing ceramic. I've seen stuff from Bulgari that I can't afford that's like gorgeous and it makes a lot of sense and it works. And then when it comes to carbon fiber, I'm just a complete fan. But the thing I always worry about is saying carbon fiber or carbon composite or forged carbon. These all suggest that there's like 30, 40, 50 different ways to make this sort of case. And I don't know actually which ones are the best ways or the not best ways, right? It's my understanding, at least, you know, some years ago, if you were doing layup carbon, essentially forming a block and then milling the watch out of that block, that's pretty good. But there's other options that are maybe more inexpensive, less helpful when it comes to some of the stresses you put a watch through. Right now, it's a little bit of like a term that's meaningless. It's carbon. That could mean that it's mostly plastic or resin, to my understanding. And then there's that. Then you get the bio-ceramic stuff with the Moon Swatch, which is like largely plastic. And I don't think that watch should be embarrassed of being plastic. It is what it is. It's clearly not hurting its sales. But yeah, I would love to see more carbon, but I would also love to see more like when even with Tudor, who I adore, like it, when they launched the two new FXDs in carbon composite, I had to like write them and ask like, is this a carbon case or is it, is the movement in a metal case, an inner case that has an outer shroud? And that's typically how it's done. I think that's probably very wise from a servicing standpoint, a longevity standpoint. With something like carbon, like let's say the Doxa or the Tissot, the thing that I still don't know, and I'm probably at the point where I just have to like be the guinea pig, is I don't know how well they actually like live up to daily wear and tear. You know, if you hit an edge of a carbon 300 on that really strong case line, does it chip? That'd probably be okay. Does it like warp? Probably less good. Does it kind of stress fracture towards the lugs? Even less good. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I this is obviously something that is coming down into more approachable and
absolutely
price points, which is great, I think. And I like seeing brands get creative in this way. You know, Ceratanium from IWC comes to mind, which is kind of like an interesting mix. If I'm not mistaken, we've got a gentleman in the back, Zach Kazan, wearing an IWC watch made of Ceratanium. So go check that out if you want to see it after. Sorry, Zach. if you want to check that out, I like how that one works.
Totally.
I have one ceramic watch and I haven't really like put it through its paces on anything, but I would. And I'm almost embarrassed to say I didn't really realize that when I bought it. Like I just like the watch. And I will say my take on this is more kind of like I it's interesting to me, but it's not going to be the thing that pushes me over the edge to buy a watch or to like oh well I don't really like that watch, but. Oh, it has a ceramic case. Oh, now I really like it. It's the whole thing has to work together for me. And I just happen to really like the design of this watch. It's a Bell & Ross multimeter with all those colorful it's barely a watch. It's more of a glorified tachymeter, but it has a black ceramic case that feels like bead blasted, which I quite like. And I know I've Rado has full ceramic cases that are totally kind of a mix of finishes, and they're all kind of over the place. But to me, it like really has to work as a whole together. And that's not going to be the one element that pushes me over into like, oh, now I like it. You know, like I have to like the way the watch looks and the story and a bunch of other things. And oh, if it's Ceratanium or ceramic or titanium or whatever, oh, cool. And you know, I guess there's certain materials that I might be a little more concerned about than others. But in generally, that's not like pushing me one way or the other. I just like seeing it be more prevalent within watches at a much broader range of prices today, and plenty of which are out that door right there. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, solid question.
Yeah. The gentleman with the black lung on.
So earlier this year, I was looking at CWC 1983 reissue and asking a group of people what they thought about it. Jason, you replied and said, hey, that's one of the best bezels out there. I bought it and, you know, that's the first thing that where my mind went to. Like, all right, let's see what this is. So it's a 60 click and that bezel is just amazing. Since then, to me, the bezel on a watch is what I've been paying attention to. Every single watch that I put on, 9 out of 10 of them have a bezel because that's where I lean towards. But a watch could fit great, it could look great, but if the bezel wasn't right, I probably would not buy it. So I'm just curious for you guys if it's, you know, what is it that matters most to you? And it doesn't have to be long term. Like for me, this could be a little niche for a year. Who knows? But is it, you know, is it lume? Is it, you know, is it the strap? Is it, what is it about a watch that really matters to you guys?
The bezel, obviously. Now, I think it's probably different things on different watches. And like the knurling on the edge of that bezel is to die for. And there are certain like little details, especially when you handle a lot of watches, you fixate on some of the smaller things. It might be easy to kind of pass over. And like small details, like the finishing on the edge, the knurling of the bezel on that watch is just stunning. But I think you become attuned to what like works and what doesn't when you handle a bunch of these things. And this is, it's tricky territory when you're reviewing these things. And I've maybe talked about this before, but you know, it's like our job, we're charged with kind of being able to say this is good for this price range because we've handled 100 other watches kind of in this price range and experienced a lot of little details like a bezel on 1,000 other watches in our lifetime. So we'll be able to kind of articulate, well, it's good because XYZ. And whereas a lot of the people that are going into a store to buy it have not experienced a lot of different watches and they might like it for other reasons. But if they hear us say, well, this is no good, but they may not have ever even noticed something like the bezel. Where you know, it's fortunate that you can try out a lot of different bezels and kind of come to a, oh, this is a good one or this is a bad one. And you got to be able to grip it. Yeah. Then that's like a practical consideration. So it's a little tricky for me to kind of like quantify those things in terms of like, well, if you like the watch, but the bezel kind of like sucks, then that's like a personal thing. Right. And it becomes that. So I don't know if it's like a make or break type thing for me, but I've become attuned to certain details, like how some things are finished or how certain things like fit together or how a bezel turns. It's 100 different things. And sometimes it's hard to put your finger on it, but you know it when you feel it. That the Seiko GMT that we were talking about earlier, the Pro Specs one, like that's one that you put it in your hand and immediately you can tell that something is elevated about it. But then it takes maybe a little more digging to figure out exactly the little few details that fit together that elevate it.
Yeah, and I would say also on the alternative, like the bezel on the SSK 003, the Seiko 5 GMT, because it doesn't click, I like kind of very, very quickly cooled on the watch. It's a great watch, but I actively recommend to people because it's a fantastic price point. And it allows you to start, if you're getting into watches, like to have a footnote for a certain size. Like an SKX is a nice middle zone. It's not thin, but it's not really that thick. It's not big, but it's definitely not small. And you're also never really that cornered in when you buy an SKX or an SSK. Like you can change it. You can do anything you want to that watch. You got a lot of options. But yeah, the bezel for me is super important. The CWC is ridiculous. They have no right to be that good. Kind of the same with the Aqualand. Like a good 60 click bezel is something really special and not that common because I think they're a little bit harder to execute upon. I would say I've given watches passes on stuff like crowns, because you just, if you, it's an automatic, if I wear it enough, I don't have to use the crown. But the bezel is definitely important. I think legibility really gets under my skin long term. It's why, like, I've never really connected that well with a Daytona. I just don't find them that easy to read quickly. You know, like, they're beautiful, they're cool. Like, you're wearing a Daytona, it's a Daytona. Like, it's good. But it's also like a car you can't see out of. Right? Like, I'm not saying I don't want to drive it. I'm just saying I maybe don't want to drive it every day.
Is that a birth year, by the way? 83? Yeah. Okay. So fellow 83 baby. Okay. Yeah, Wisconsin. Yeah, happy 40th or almost 40th. So, Kat and Jason.
Yeah, I think for me, something that's really surprised me in the last year that I've been paying attention to, and maybe it's because I photograph watches so much, is the side profile of the watch. And it's something that I almost can't tell on my own wrist. I have to see it on someone else. But there's something about it, and I'm just like, that is the watch, you know. And a lot of it is with dive watches and their bezel and how they look on the side. And it's just something that I've become enamored with. And I've gotten rid of watches that I just don't really like the way it looks on the side of the case, which is a really weird and peculiar thing. But that's what we do, so you know. And legibility is a great point too. I've sold watches that are just hard to read and they just don't last in my collection, and sort of picky about that too. If you're going to spend that much on a watch, you got to be able to read it. You know?
Yeah, I think that's a big point too. Like, seeing a watch on someone else is really how you should see it. That's why I think like wrist shots are pretty important in stories, because like even now I look around and I'm looking at watches like, I like pretty much all of these.
Lusting after like a lot of watches that I see on other people's wrists. Like,
it's super fun. Great. Yeah,
I guess it's a sign of the times that none of us said precision or accuracy, you know. But I think it's easier to answer the question, what isn't important to a person with a watch? And I think for me, I really don't give a hoot about in-house movements. I also don't really care much about, to a certain degree, about finishing. I think it probably goes to the types of watches that I like and buy and I own. I think, you know, the way something, a movement specifically is finished is just not important to me. And just speaking from my own kind of preferences and the ways I use watches, I think for a dive watch, you know, really a lot of it comes down to, and I know you can change straps, but the strap a watch comes on, or the way the strap fits on a watch, or the ease with which you can switch a strap, or a watch will take a strap, is important. Bezel grip is huge. Kind of the feel of a bezel. I think, you know, Citizen did that, the Challenge Diver. And I think my one quibble with that was the bezel felt a little bit light. You know, and it's one of these intangibles where you feel it and it's just like, it's just not quite there. Whereas like this Aqualand, or that, if you go out and try that 1,000 meter crazy eco drive that they have at their booth, like with the locking mechanism, it feels really so precision. It's such a fun piece to play with. I think lume is important, but I always chuckle when I think about accuracy, because you can really tell that we're kind of the people we are, kind of watch enthusiasts, that we aren't. I mean, it's kind of strange that we aren't concerned with that, right?
Yeah, a little bit, and we probably should be to some. That's why I mentioned that about the Seiko. You know, like,
well, and especially given the emphasis that so many brands put on, like Metas certification,
sure,
and COSC and whatever, they're really playing this up, and very few of us. I know James just bought a timing machine not long ago, and he's been using it, and he's been using it in reviews and things. And I think that's an interesting, and I almost would like to see that present in more reviews than even just the dimensions of a watch, because I think, you know, yes, I think watches are 90% aesthetic. I think we look at them. It's a looks thing. It's the way they look on your wrist and how much you smile when you see it on your wrist. But I think, I mean, accuracy, I mean, come on, we've got to hold it to that basic, you know, kind of the basic requirement of a watch, right?
All right. Well, what I mean, to bring back to like the material question, and I'll say this, like I'm impressed by what, like the medicine and all the stuff that I see people doing. I'm very impressed by it. And it's the same with like in-house movements. If they're doing something interesting, oh, that's cool. But it's not the thing that usually is like pushing me one way or the other on it.
Right,
it's not gonna
right,
like stop me from buying a watch I like, but it's also probably not going to like get me to buy a watch that I'm like kind of cold on.
You know? I remember when Omega, you know, in the early 2000s, they were starting to really play up the coaxial movements. And I thought, what a weird thing to use in their advertising and to really tout. Because I'm like, does the average person who walks in and buys an Omega, can they relate to what that means? I mean, it's such a level deeper than most people. You can talk about accuracy, but then like to talk about, you know, the escapement. I mean, it's just such a sort of ethereal concept to the average watch buyer.
But it sounds cool.
It certainly does. Yeah, right.
And so does Ceratanium.
Sort of superlative.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Superlative. Yeah. Yeah. We might as well put it on the dial. Yeah. We see what they're doing there. Obviously, like they, you know, the average Joe walks into a,
it's marketing. A deal. It's like,
yeah. Oh, coaxial. Let's get it. You know, that one doesn't have that. Sounds good. Like, let's go. Right.
Yeah.
But being able to say this will keep accurate time to within a second a day, that I think is more tangible. Like, oh, I understand that, you know.
Yeah, and I think like with a brand that has stood out for me for that more than even Omega or Rolex or some of the bigger Swiss brands is Grand Seiko. You know, like you talk about like a 9F Grand Seiko quartz movement or the spring drives, and it's like when they're talking accuracy within seconds a year. I mean, that's impressive to me. That stands out. Or the anti-magnetic qualities of some of these watches. I think that's also an important thing too.
Yeah. Definitely.
I have a question, just a real quick. Do you all open up time.gov to set your watches every day when you put them on?
I use the clock and the Hodinkee app, which references the same.
All right, Mr. Hodinkee clock. Is
then I get in there, I learn a little bit about the leap year.
Okay.
I get in there, yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. What about you guys? Do you use the time.gov? Do you know what I'm talking about? You hack the seconds hand right at 60, then you wait for the...
I just use the clock on the Apple iPhone. Yeah, and match to that.
Oh, okay.
Pretty close.
That's what I do too. Just use my phone.
Okay. But I mean, otherwise, if we're caring about like the second a day, like it's got to be to something, right? Set to something. Does anybody else use time.gov?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, a few of us. Okay. Even this guy. Okay. Oh, awesome. Yeah. It's something that I have to, if the movement hacks, I cannot help myself. I have to.
I'd rather stop it at zero. And
that.
Even if I don't get the reference to the time perfectly, I want it at zero and I want to start the minute hand at the marker.
Yeah. All right. Do we have time for one final question?
At least one.
All
right. Same question as last year. There's a lot of people that aren't here, and this doesn't feel like a Grey NATO podcast without a weather update and a moving update.
The second one was?
Moving update.
Oh, I'm fully moved. I can give you that one. I'm fully moved in. The boxes are gone. Today in Toronto, it's high 20s, 27, 28, pretty muggy, I think, according to my wife. She's currently on a fairly sizable bike ride to a thrift store. I think that's probably the update. It's definitely summer. It's very similar weather to here.
Yeah, and on my side, I haven't moved in 20 years. So, I mean, the weather outside here is, I mean, you've all experienced it. It was kind of a sweaty day yesterday. You know, I drove down from Minneapolis on Friday and in an unair-conditioned vehicle, and it was a bit of a masochistic exercise. No cruise control, no AC, and then I hit the Chicago traffic, and I was second guessing the whole decision.
Yeah, 90's got a lane closed coming from the west into Chicago, so yeah. that didn't
horrible
situation. Jason, the state of Wisconsin, welcome you back anytime. You're ready.
I will be headed there as soon as we're done.
And I speak on behalf of all Wisconsinites in this room, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, anytime you need to make that move, we're here for you. What about you?
Nashville? Yeah. It's probably hot as hell right now.
Probably hot as hell.
That's what they say right on the screen.
Hot as hell.
Don't worry about it. It's hot. All right. Well, this has been a huge treat. I can't thank James and Jason you enough for
coming on.
It really means a lot. And to be here in Chicago to do this with us, it's just a huge treat. So
it's
thank you.
It's a tradition.
Yeah.
It's a tradition.
Thanks for having us.
As is diving in the lake.
Lake
2023, 2024 and beyond. We'll see where this goes. And maybe Lake Como coming soon.
It was approved. You all heard it.
Yes, yeah. we're all witness. Clooney will put us up in his backyard.
Right. Maybe
we can bring a bunch of tents or something like that. Well, thank you all for being here. It really means a lot. And thank you all for your presence here in Chicago at the Wind Up Fair. Diving, super incredible and humbling to meet each and every one of you. It was just awesome. We'll have more on the Benriss and on Worn and Wound. I'm sure that you will over on Hodinkee as well. And we'll have coverage of the dive and all that kind of stuff. So anyways, thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, take care.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there we go. That was our half of the Wind Up Chicago Worn and Wound shared podcast. Hope everybody enjoyed it. I thought it was a blast. There's something very different about doing live podcasts. I think there's a certain energy in the room that we don't get when we're just doing it over Zoom like we normally do. And I really enjoyed that. That was great.
Yeah, totally. I had a blast. Again, a big thank you to everyone who came out. We were well represented, especially in the front row. We had some tough customers up front there to support us. So I appreciate it. It's always a highlight. Last year, we did a lot of episodes from the show. We talked with a bunch of kind of brand leaders and that sort of thing. And I kind of missed that this year, if I'm honest. But the show was kind of formatted a little bit differently. They were doing a little bit less of that sort of space. And I'm hoping that we can maybe replicate something like that in New York in the next few months. We'll just have to see if we can make that work for the schedule. Yeah, beyond that, Jason, you want to hit up some final notes and put a bow on it?
Yeah, good idea. You know, I spent a lot of time driving this past weekend in the took the Defender down from Minneapolis straight through to Chicago. It was 9 hours door to door with a lot of traffic and it was pretty hot, whatever. So my kind of way of doing that sort of trip, which I did done before, it's a loud vehicle. So I use my AirPods with noise canceling on. And I know, you know, probably get some feedback from people saying that's not safe, but we can cross that bridge when we get to it. The noise canceling does help with kind of the road noise, obviously. But I also listen to audiobooks and it passes the time really nicely. And the book that I'm just about done with now is called Aquanaut by Rick Stanton. And it's not necessarily a new book. It's been out for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half. Rick Stanton, if you're not familiar, was or is one of the British cave divers who participated in the rescue of the 13 Thai soccer team players that were trapped in that cave. The very famous rescue story a few years ago. They made a couple of movies about it. His character was played by Viggo Mortensen, who did a great job. But Rick wrote this book with a co-author called Aquanaut, and the audiobook's tremendous. I mean, it's great. It's a great story, not just about the rescue, which he goes into a lot of detail about, but the book is formatted such that each chapter or it's sort of split back and forth between going back in time to his early years, getting into cave diving and his kind of full career back to the 80s, all up through the present and all the places he's dived and some of the rescues he's done and, you know, his attitudes about equipment and his life and things like that. And then it cuts back to the Thailand situation. And that whole rescue just still boggles my mind how they carried that out and what heroes those guys were and everybody that took part in that. So check it out. I mean, great diving books are always fun to come across because there just aren't a ton of them. And I would put this up there. I put it off for a while reading it, but it was a great one to listen to on the way to wind up. And I'm about 3 hours from the end and I'm a little sad that I won't have it to listen to on the drive home from Milwaukee. I'll have to find something else for that remaining 5 or 6 hours I've got on Wednesday. So
heat too.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah, exactly. Right.
That's great. That sounds like an amazing recommendation. I love the idea of doing it as an audiobook as well.
Yeah. So check it out. Yeah, put a link in the show notes. We can link to the audiobook that I'm listening to from Apple Books or just Amazon or wherever, however you like to read your books. So check it out. How about you? What do you got?
Yeah, mine this week is actually a topic I had with a couple fun conversations about in Chicago based on this article, which I originally thought was written by somebody at the Intercooler, but it turns out there's another reason why I enjoyed it. It's from Jalopnik. It was written by Elizabeth Blackstock, who's incredible. And it's a whole thing about, this will be for the F1 fans in the audience, but I think there's a fair number of you. It's a whole thing comparing Red Bull racing, the current era of Red Bull racing, to the sort of golden era of Ferrari's F1 program under the guidance of Enzo Ferrari. So recently, for those who care but don't know, Red Bull Racing has two teams, Red Bull Racing and AlphaTauri. And one of the drivers for AlphaTauri is a brand new driver, a rookie named Nick De Vries, and he's been cut. He lost his seat already, which is fairly uncommon to not let somebody have a whole season.
Yeah.
But it's not uncommon for the folks that run Red Bull. This is how they operate. So Daniel Ricciardo is going to take his seat. He's been sitting as the reserve driver for Red Bull, which puts him in contention or as an option for some seat time for AlphaTauri. So it's a big kind of shakeup. It's one of the big news items from F1 this year. They're playing a different sort of game at Red Bull than everybody else is with their drivers, and there's no option to not be performing. So De Vries, sadly, I don't think he'd place higher than 12 in any race, so no points.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth Blackstock is one of the co-authors, along with Alanis King, for Racing with Rich Energy, How a Rogue Sponsor Took Formula One for a Ride. Also an incredible story, a book I haven't quite finished, but I've enjoyed every page of it so far. I do really enjoy her writing, and I think this is an interesting perspective comparing like kind of suggesting that there's like a methodology to some of these things that are very different from one team to another. So if you're into Formula One or you like kind of the politics of it, it's a pretty fun story, and Elizabeth does a beautiful job putting it all together.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good long episode. I think, kind of a fitting way to kind of close out what was an amazing weekend. And I'm glad people, even if you couldn't make it to the show, you can kind of get a little vicarious glimpse into it through this episode, this shared episode with Warren and Wound.
And yeah, as always, thank you so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab yourself a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Yogi Berra, who said, "The future ain't what it used to be."